Hey friends, I hope you're well. Jumping in here to make a little announcement. Actually, it's kind of a big announcement for me, at least. After spending like a decade, basically, doing this podcast, interviewing authors, musicians, leaders, I have finally written something of my own. I'm really excited about it. This has been a long time coming. It's a long story, and I'll go into that story in detail at some later time, but today I'll just say my book is out. It was co-authored with John Perkins. Many of you probably know who he is, a pastor, civil rights leader. He has an amazing story. If you haven't, go out and grab his books, especially the ones that are more of a memoir. Let Justice Roll Down is probably his first one, and then he's had some after that. They're phenomenal. I had the supreme honor of co-writing this book with him. It's called Go and Do, and you can check it out now. You can get it on Amazon or wherever books are sold, but I will tell you that you can get it for 40% off if you go to my website and go to the tab that says, what does it say? The tab that says discount code. So if you go to shaneblackshear.com/discount-code, it will take you to a place where you can put your email in, sign up, and you will automatically get an email with a coupon code for 40% off. So definitely save that money and go purchase there. If not, like I said, you can, if you want to pay full price, go to Amazon. I won't see any more of that money, so it's fine with me either way. I'd rather you get the discount. So please do that. Like I said, I will be sharing more about this book when the time comes, but for now, it's out. It's there, and I would be honored if you would read it. Okay, here's the show.
Hi, I'm Deb.
This is Frankie V.
I'm Grant.
Hi, this is Phil.
I'm Aaron.
I'm Steven.
Hi, I'm Joe.
Hi, I'm Matt.
We're Tim and Terry.
I'm Susan.
Hi, this is Phil.
Seminary Dropout is supported by listeners like you and me.
Seminary Dropout is supported by listeners like you and me.
You should support the show like I did.
It's easy.
It's easy.
Just visit supportseminarydropout.com.
Just go to supportseminarydropout.com.
And I'm your host, Shane Blackshear. Interviews with leading Christian authors, leaders, and thinkers. Let's go. My guest, Kelly Fabian, is a lawyer in Chicago representing nonprofits and churches. For many years before that, Kelly was a pastor at Willow Creek Community Church and a founding member of The Practice, an alternative practice-based worship service at Willow Creek. Kelly continues to lead spiritual discipline workshops and practices, write and explore encounters and transformative journeys with God. She's written two books, Sacred Questions, A Transformative Journey Through the Bible, and the book that we're talking about today, Holy Vulnerability, Spiritual Practices for the Broken, Ashamed, Anxious, and Afraid. Kelly Fabian, thanks for being with me on Seminary Dropout. How are you?
Doing well. Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it. It's fun to be with you.
What made you decide to write a book about spiritual practices?
Well, gosh, that's a hard one. Well, in some ways it's hard, in some ways it's easy. I guess I would say, you know, first and foremost, I need them, spiritual practices, that is. And so I feel like I spent a lot of my time thinking through, different ways that I can grow closer to God. And I think this one in particular, Holy Vulnerability, is one that grew out of a particular circumstance where I just felt like, gosh, if I could invite God into this somehow, I would, I think, be able to manage better than I'm managing now without, or maybe with sort of just trying to manage it on my own is the best way to say it. So I need it. I need spiritual practices. And there are certain circumstances that I realize, oh, I really need spiritual practices.
Well, you're really open and vulnerable in the book about your wrestling with anxiety and fear. And I feel like for a lot of us, we kind of feel like those are just maybe parts of being human and just something we just kind of have to deal with. And it's something separate than what we do on Sunday morning in our liturgy, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think we tend to do that with a lot of things where it's like church is Sunday, and then the rest of the time I'm sort of on my own, or, you know, something to that effect. Or we all have, you know, maybe just different areas of our lives that we don't really submit to the idea that Christ has an interest in those areas. So fear and anxiety, I would say, it's not like I ever thought, you know, consciously, oh, God doesn't care about this. It's more like it thinking about my own anxiety and fear in particular circumstances made me realize, in conjunction with reading, you know, certain passages of scripture, that wait, God not only wants to be invited into these places, but will actually sort of show up during these moments that that feel like we're at our weakest. I mean, this is what, in large part, I think Paul talks about when he talks about being weak and, you know, God's power being made perfect in our weakness. There's all these weaknesses we have. And if we could realize that church or God's presence among us isn't just on Sunday, it will take us a long way in being healed and just even being closer to God ourselves.
One of the things that you bring up, and I can't believe I hadn't really thought on this very much, but was the fact that in Scripture, most of the people who come to Jesus are looking for physical healing from something, and they're not compartmentalizing it. And not once does Jesus chastise them for not seeking something spiritual, you know?
That's so true. I think that sometimes the way we view our bodies is, you know, for as much integration theories there are in the world and the culture about, you know, we're mind and body, Christianity has, you know, for so long separated those, and we have separated those so that we kind of forget that one of the most fundamental, I mean, maybe even the most fundamental thing about being human is that we have these bodies. And it is crazy to think that if God made us this way with these bodies, that they would be somehow disconnected to our relationship with Him and what He's seeking to heal in us.
You know, as we're on like the third year of a pandemic now. Somebody said this pandemic's in its junior year.
gosh.
I know. It's so hard to believe.
I hope they're not going to be a fifth year senior.
Either. Yeah. Let's drop out now, please.
Right.
I was thinking, you know, I really worry that much of the church has learned the wrong lesson here, which is with all of the churches pivoting in a way that was necessary to do things online, to meet on Zoom, those sorts of things. I feel like the lesson the church learned was to be less embodied in our, specifically, obviously, in our gatherings. And, you know, like I said, I think that was a really necessary thing for a time. But I'm afraid that's the lesson we're learning, is it needs to be more of that going forward and less togetherness. And it feels like that's a theme. The disembodiedment is a theme running really in the Western church, really in the white church. And I'm wondering why you think we've got that so wrong in the past and now.
I mean, the point you make about the pandemic and kind of what we did in the church to adjust to that, and then what that means going forward, is a really good one, because I agree with you. Like, I see, you know, more and more churches saying, oh, now what we need to do is accommodate both the in-person, the embodied service, and the Zoom service, or, you know, pick your online platform. The idea being, after this has happened, there are going to be people who don't ever return to church in a physical way, but rather just decide they're going to, you know, lay on their couch in their pajamas, which, don't get me wrong, that's a fabulous way to spend a Sunday morning. But we miss something very significant about being in community and being human, which is being bodies together. I think what's interesting about it, and we just have to kind of see how it unfolds. But I think that we don't even recognize the consequences of that until later. So I think, like, I think it seems really good right now. I mean, it's hard. I certainly would say this is not a good thing that we would become totally on Zoom, but I'm not exactly sure, other than to say it's good for us to be together physically, why that is. I just know that it is better to be together physically. And so because of the lack of, I don't know, anything beyond just kind of the obvious, like, of course we should be, like, we're human, we're in bodies. Of course we should be together, not over a screen. I mean, which seems simplistic, but I think that's the long and short of it, is it's just isn't good for us to be in this, like, you know, different kind of realm where we're not together. And I think because it seems so consistent with where everything else is headed, business meetings, you know, conferences, you name it, the church is kind of like, well, it can't be too bad. And maybe it is an alternative that is helpful to people. And I think what we're going to see in who knows how many years, maybe not that many, a real problem in the church, I don't even know what it's going to be, but there's something. I mean, I've even played with the idea, is Christ really among us when two or three gather, but not physically? I don't know. it's a really interesting question. And so if that's not true, if it's true that Christ is only among us when we're together physically, what does that mean then about holding church or even holding small groups and community virtually?
And so, you know, if we bring this back to our spiritual practices, our spiritual disciplines, we have this propensity to think, again, I think this is especially in the West, that we're going to arrange our mental furniture. And if we can, that's all we need to do to get ourselves out of our anxiety and our fear and our sin. If we just arrange the mental furniture right, that's going to be the answer to anything. And, you know, again, those are good things, right? But they're all disembodied practices.
Yeah. I mean, that's certainly what I have done for most of my Christian life, is just, or at least much of it is, like, if I believe the right things and if I, you know, can adjust my thinking in the right ways, then I will be, you know, living consistent with the way God is seeking for me to live. And again, you say, and I think you're absolutely right, that is a good thing. And in the same verse that I mentioned from Romans 12, where Paul talks about giving of our bodies as a living sacrifice, he also talks about our minds. And so it's not like I'm suggesting or we're suggesting body over mind, but rather it has to be both. And for so long, we've really limited our kind of ways of getting in touch with God, or ways of opening ourselves with God is a better way of saying it, to our minds. And so, like, well, if I read and I process this way, if I think these thoughts, if I pray these words, that opens me to God. And I think those things do, and that they've been shown to over time. But largely, if you look at the practices over a long historical period, they are, even those practices are teamed up with physical practices. Reading scripture aloud is a great example.
Yeah. And even when we are engaged in prayer, the postures our bodies are taking. And I can remember I got to interview Richard Foster years ago. And one of the things I wanted to ask him was, what are your spiritual disciplines in your daily life? And his answer was, you know, I really like to be outside in nature and walk and hike and, you know, be aware of the presence of God. And it was something, you know, that's something he did with his body.
I've often thought about how, like, I've wanted to write a book called Taking a Walk with Jesus or something like that, which sounds a little cheesy. But if you look in scripture throughout the Gospels, like, he's always walking, you know, I mean, every story kind of involves these moments of walking alongside people and having people walk alongside him. And I'm not trying to use that as a metaphor, but really as a reality, that there's something about the physical movement of our bodies that is inherently both human and divine. You know, there's this marrying of two different ideas that we've separated so much, kind of the things that we think and the ways that we act, that come together in the body that, you know, when we are in touch with that, when we're connected with our bodies, there, to me at least, there is a more significant opportunity to engage with God.
And also, Jesus is also using the creative world, you know, when he's walking around and he's saying, hey, look at this tree, you know. He's rarely saying to the disciples, like, hey, you know that thought you have when you think about this way, or like that feeling you have, you know? It's always coming back to like the physical material world.
Otherwise, what would be the purpose of all of this, you know? I mean, it's kind of like, if you look even back in the garden, there's a high engagement with the body and with the physical world. And it would be very odd to suggest that as time has gone by, we've sort of become a people that can be completely separate from our bodies and from our created world. I think we were made to be in the world. I don't mean that as John says it, but made to be sort of, touching the ground in a part of the earth.
So then what are some ways that we marry these two things, our spiritual life and our spiritual practices and our bodies? You spend the last third of the book detailing some of those ways. So what are some of those practices look like?
Yeah. So I mentioned six of them in the book. The ones that deeply resonate with me the most often, I would say, are kind of this idea of eating together. And again, that it's one of those things that when you sit down at a table with fellow believers and eat together, there's something different that happens as you're sitting there than if you're eating alone or if you're eating in your car on the way to work or, you know, whatever the various ways that we eat. There's something very sacred that happens there. And often, so I used to have, I talk about this in the book, but I used to have these big dinners arranged around a particular time when some friends from Africa would be in town. And every year I had this, you know, all this food and had to rent tables and all this stuff. And it would be like the most sacred, fun, meaningful time. But every year I would dread it. Every year as it started to get closer, I would be like, oh, I don't know. Is this really worth it? And I think that is something that generally plagues us, maybe more us introverts than extroverts. But we often don't try things because we hesitate around them, or we think it's going to be work or, you know, whatever. And then the thing itself ends up being amazing. And so I think that in some ways, and I feel like I'm rambling a bit here, but that's the practice of it. That's the discipline of it, is that you have to kind of be in this rhythm or this habit of doing it. And it's in the habit of doing it that it forms you. So if you have one dinner, you could walk away and be like, wow, that was amazing. It likely won't form anything in you over the long term. But if you continue to have dinners or meals with believers and with non-believers too, I'm not suggesting that it really can't be that. There's something in you that gets formed, this desire and this need for community, a need to connect food and the enjoyment of kind of these earthly things with others. So that's one that deeply engages me. Another one is what I'm calling digging in the dirt, which again feels very visceral and you know, bodily, because it's like it means what it really says, digging in the dirt. And that could mean repotting a plant, or it could mean weeding your garden or whatever. There's not a whole lot to be done in the winter, so that's going to be repotting for me. And there's something very uniquely connective about being physical in the actual elements of the earth. And this doesn't mean God is in the earth. Like, there's this weird pantheistic kind of sense to that, but that's not what I mean. There's a way of connecting ourselves to our humanity, that we rely on the earth, and then having sort of God connect to us in the midst of that. So being truly human, being the things that make us human, eating, being on the earth, those are the things that actually open us to the presence of God.
You know, you have an emphasis in the book on accepting our humanity and our limitations and all that entails, you know, in our bodies, you know, and they, all the like the things that we would consider gross, you know, they stink, they sag, whatever, you know, but accepting that that's who we are. And as we grow older, they fail us in different ways, you know, and accepting that is who we are as a really freeing effect. And I feel like there's a connection there to eating together, because we're kind of like collectively admitting our mortality to each other. Like, I have to put this food in my mouth to sustain my body, you know?
I love that. That's a great way of saying that. Yeah.
I love too that you had a chapter on laughter. And I think of, I don't know if I have ever read in all the books I've read about spiritual formation, a role for laughter. And I think once you named it, it was so intuitive. And also, as someone who grew up as a comedy nerd, I really appreciate that as well. And the joy I get from like laughing with other people and other people making me laugh and me laughing with other people, how just enriching that is to a community. And also how I think of when Christian communities really bond, it's usually, I mean, I can go to church with someone for a long time, but if we do like there's some sort of, you know, a retreat or something where it's less planned and we're kind of really joking around or you know, just sharing life with each other, like those are the times when a bond, a fellowship is really formed, you know?
I totally agree. I think if anyone could try this, like think back to the best relationships that you have or that you have had over time. And I bet that most people would say, they would remember a time when they laughed so hard, you know, that their stomach hurt or whatever, because we remember those moments. They really stick with us. They're formative, and they're not only formative for us as humans, but in that, whatever that relationship is, it something connects in that moment when you're laughing together. And, you know, that's why I think when we're most vulnerable, so think of a funeral. I mean, how many times people feel like laughing at funerals? And it's not because anything is funny. It's because it's so human there, right? Like death is just so much part of being human, and so is laughter. So you put those two together and it's like, you're going to have these moments of, you know, high emotion, whether it's crying and mourning or laughing. They are so fundamentally human that it's like they can't help but come out when we're feeling, you know, emotions right on the surface. So I agree with you. Like those are bonding moments in community when laughter is had. And it's something that is so overlooked, the importance of it, I think, in Christianity as a whole. Because, you know, the comeback when you read books about laughter in scripture is like, well, Jesus never laughed. So obviously laughter is terrible. But I think my theory is, and it's not just mine, of course, but is that like, it was so fundamentally obvious, like that none of the gospel writers said anything about it because it's so human that of course Jesus laughed. Like it would be weird to say, and then he laughed hysterically at the joke that Peter told, you know, that wasn't what the story they were telling. But also I can just imagine, like, they also didn't say, and Jesus went to the bathroom, but of course we know as a human that he would have. So it's so tied to our humanity, and, you know, across all times and all peoples that, to me, it's one of those things that God gifted to us. And it really is a gift.
There's a group of friends that I would go out with on a weekly basis for a while. And when that night of the week rolled around, I would think to myself, you know, I'm tired. It's kind of across town. And sometimes I would just go anyway. And every time, Kelly, when I left, I would think, why did I think about not doing this? Like, and then I experience this too now after I spend time with friends. I come home and it's almost like, it's almost weird. It's almost like I've had a shot of B12 or something. Like I'm yeah. So much happier, in a better mood. I feel good, you know, and all I've done is spend a couple hours with friends, you know, laughing and sharing life together. And I think it would be easy to, you know, just point to the scientific explanations for that. But I think that there really is something spiritual going on there, and God is reaching us through each other in our community together.
Yeah. I mean, I have the same things where even just going anywhere, I'm like, oh, I mean, I'm sure it'll be fun, but it's, you know, whatever the excuses are that you come up with. And then you get there and you're like, this is amazing. What, you know, and that's not true of every gathering. Obviously some are hard, but I think that's one of the reasons you keep doing it. It's like anything, you know, there's going to be ups and downs in different relationships and different things, but the goodness of it outweighs in every respect the downsides, or the inconvenience is a better way of saying it, of going.
You know, one of the other practices that you talk about is the practice of common prayer. And I feel like a lot of us who were raised evangelical are just kind of waking up to these ancient practices and finding out how helpful they are. I have to confess, this is embarrassing. I'm pretty sure just reading your book was the first time I realized they call it common prayer, because it's the prayer. It's not an individual prayer. It's common prayer for all of us.
yeah.
but I thought, how beautiful is that, that we don't own it, that it's this gift for all of the church, for everyone. And, you know, when I put my kids to bed at night, one of the things that I do is I pray the Lord's Prayer over them. And that's, you know, that's a common prayer from Scripture. We haven't always acknowledged it as such. But that's a written prayer that they've given us. And so many times when I'm in distress, I don't have the words to pray. And I feel like what common prayer does is it gives us the words when we don't have the words.
Absolutely. I just the other night, I had gotten the vaccine booster, and which is a really weird experience, because it's like, you know, like you could get sick. So you're just like waiting for it. Is it going to happen? Is it not going to happen? So I ended up basically just being so achy was kind of the side effect I got. And I could barely stand being inside my own body, which was a really interesting and terrible experience. But when I was suffering in that way, I was saying the Lord's Prayer, because I was sitting there thinking, I mean, this is so dumb and embarrassing and very vulnerable, so maybe it's apt for this, but like, I was thinking, I want to pray. I should pray. Like, I was thinking this over and over. I should pray. And then I wouldn't do anything. I would just be kind of like moaning or something in the pain that I was experiencing. But so then I was like, common prayer. Okay. I mean, you know, now you're getting a real inside look into what's going on in my head, but I'm like, I should pray a common prayer. I should pray the Our Father. So I start praying it, and it's transformative, because now my mind is occupied with this prayer that, had I not sort of had the words, I think I would have just been reeling, you know. But now I'm like structuring what I'm saying. And as I'm saying it, I'm also thinking, I wonder why Jesus taught us this prayer in particular. And, you know, I'm analyzing it, but also feeling just very inside of it. And it was beautiful. But if I did not know those words, and I think this is true when you're sick, when you're totally stressed out, when you're having anxiety or a panic attack, and when you're in a significant sort of situation of fear, if you don't have the language that you need, the way we've been raised and trained, where words are so important and so meaningful, you kind of are at a loss and you can spin out. But I think when we have those common prayers, the Lord's Prayer and others, they ground us and they make us, they allow us, is a better way of saying it, like to come back to God and invite Him in without needing to make it up on our own. This is, you know, Jesus told us this prayer, and He used it to show us how to invite God in. And so I have come to really rely on common prayers.
One of the things that you talk about is your, you talk about your, anxiety that you've experienced in life, your fear, specifically your fear of flying. And then also you talk about coping mechanisms, which I think we all have. And I think that one of the things that I realized when reading the book was, I have coping mechanisms. I kind of recognize that they're coping mechanisms, but because I can't link them to a certain sin, then I don't really know what to do with them, if that makes sense. So like, you know, if someone's an alcoholic, then it's probably easy to say, you know, you're numbing yourself from feeling something. But so many coping mechanisms are in and of themselves morally neutral, you know? You know, looking at Facebook on my phone or whatever, there's not anything wrong with that in and of itself. But what I realize is that I think most of my coping mechanisms they're avoiding something else. Whether it's an idle moment in my head to think about how mortal I am or whatever it is, these are things that I'm using to avoid. And I feel like one of the points you're getting across is that these practices help us to not avoid and to be in touch with what's going on and what's the thing underneath the thing.
Yeah, I think so much of it is about awareness. So, you know, like you said, if you are scrolling through Facebook or whatever, that's not in and of itself any, you know, a sin. But what I've noticed is, like, when am I picking it up, the phone, to scroll through Facebook? I mean, sometimes it's just boredom. And I don't think I do not believe we are called to be, as our society suggests, productive every second of every day. There is a time to just rest and enjoy the world. What I would say, though, is like they can be signs that there's something else going on, like you say. So recently I've started cracking my knuckles so much and I'm like, okay, what is going on? And some of it's boredom. Some of it's, I think, some level of my anxiety. But what I use it for is sort of a sign that there might be something else going on. The other thing is, if you're doing those things, like if you're scrolling through Facebook and you're not engaged in it, so like there could be a moment where you're looking at Facebook and there's a really interesting article. Today I was reading one about domestic violence on Facebook and I was, you know, super engaged. That wasn't coping because I was present in the moment. But when you're just like scrolling, trying to get through time or trying, you know, whatever that thing is that we do, which is so common, it's just it's not to be judgmental. It's not a moral question. It's just like, what's going on here? Why am I, you know, needing to escape this moment? So that's a good way of just, you know, bringing yourself awareness. And I think the practices are designed to allow you to continue to have that increased awareness, not to make you super disciplined and never, you know, look at Facebook or never crack your knuckles or all the different things that we do, but rather to see those as signs that there might be something else going on that you can invite God into.
For me, and this isn't something I've come up with. In fact, you mentioned it too. The key for me seems to be just being curious about it. And I feel like that's kind of the trap that we find ourselves in, where we can be entertained 24/7, is that we're filling in the gaps where we have these compulsive behaviors, these coping mechanisms, and even the spaces to be curious about them are also taken up with the same things, you know?
Yes, we have no margin. Like, we don't allow any margin because the margin that we even used to have is now filled with scrolling through Facebook or something, or like checking TikTok, you know?
And so many things that we do that could seem so innocuous, and maybe sometimes they are, but we're not even present enough to think about if they are, to evaluate it, if they are or not, to be curious about it. And so for me, I try to recognize that when I have patterns, and when my patterns, habits, and things that seem to really preoccupy my time, that those are in the very least red flags for coping mechanisms or things that I should be curious about.
Yeah, I think that's a great way of saying it. Yeah, just, and like the thing I want to avoid is someone, you know, sort of either being so overly critical of themselves, like, oh, I do this, I do this, I do this. Not that, not shame, that kind of thing, judgment, but rather, oh, I'm doing this again. Interesting, you know, like curious, wonder why. my husband will sometimes, like, if he like goes to the kitchen and wants a bag of chips or a bag of Chex Mix or something, he'll be like, I'm eating a lot right now. I wonder if there's something else going on, you know? So it's kind of just, it's not being judgmental of yourself, but rather just curious about behaviors that are more of a pattern, you know, and you start to notice them.
Yeah, I think that's so good, because I think I've also found that the curiosity has to be not judgmental curiosity at myself. Like, I will not overcome things by shaming myself out of them. And recognizing that, like, that's the real turning point.
I agree. And, you know, the other thing is that, and this is a little bit sad to say, but we're not going to be healed of everything in this life. And so I, like, one of my big ahas was knowing that, you know, my anxiety, my goal is not to be healed of it. I mean, that would be great, but that's not my goal. My goal is to invite God into it. So, and to experience what I'm experiencing in those moments with God instead of without Him. And what that brings is actually, in some ways, healing. And it also brings God's grace into it, kind of to your point. You know, whereas in the past, I might have been like kind of beat myself up about being so fearful of flying. It's like, you know, people would say, well, you know, the statistics, it's like one in such and such. I'm like, yes, I know that in my brain, but my body just does not accept that. And so instead of beating myself up about it, it's just like, yeah, I have this fear of flying and I'm still going to do it, but I'm going to, you know, sort of work through all the different ways that God is with me in it and where my trust really is, which is what it comes down to, is what you're putting your trust in.
You know, something that I feel like I've learned recently is that God deals with us in reality. And I think that it sounds cliche, because I think those of us in church for a while have heard it so many times, to say that we don't have to, you know, clean ourselves up before we meet with God or whatever. But there, I feel like we've lost a real powerful truth, which is that God meets with us in reality and wherever it is. So we don't, the situation I'm thinking of, I was telling a friend, I have during my life always struggled with anger, and I am starting to see that in my 4-year-old son as well. And so I've thought about what would it look like to, with him, say, hey, what if we invite Jesus in on this to help us with our anger? And so, whereas I think the compulsion is to say, how do we bury this anger down deep? Or how do we get some life hacks to work around this anger? Instead of saying, what if we invite Jesus in on this? Because Jesus will meet us in reality. And this is our reality at the moment. And I feel like one of the things you've done in this book is really give us the steps, the flesh, the embodiment of, like, actually how to do that, you know?
Yeah, I love that example, because anger, like anxiety, I think can be something that, you know, it's not like a momentary thing. A lot of times it's sort of in there under the surface. And the thing about these practices that I write about is, it's not like, okay, you have an angry episode and now go dig in the dirt. That's not the idea. Although that's how I kind of discovered it, was having this really anxious moment and then was, you know, weeding. But the idea instead is build those practices into your everyday life. And that actually will inform that kind of constant, whatever it is, you know, your anger will start to lose its grip, because you're kind of in consistent communion with God in these ways and with your body. With anxiety, when I consistently do those things, there's a calm that comes over me. It's not like I am not ever anxious, but it's more like I have this consistent communion with God through these practices. And as a result of that consistency, I'm better able to deal with and live into even that anxiety that I have, as that's part of who I am.
Well, Kelly, this is a lovely book. Thanks for writing it, and thanks for being on the show.
Thank you so much, Shane. I really appreciate it. And thanks how attentive you were to it. And I just really appreciate that.
Oh, thank you. Thanks for joining me for another episode of Seminary Dropout. Remember, you can find all the show notes for this show and all shows at shaneblackshear.com. Oh, and hey, have you ever thought about starting your very own podcast? I bet you have. And I think you should do it. In fact, I've created a course just for you to teach you everything that I've learned over the last couple of years producing Seminary Dropout. So if you're interested in podcasting and want to learn how, go check out my course. You can go there by typing in podcastingforeveryone.org. And you can get a special discount by typing in the discount code Seminary Dropout, all one word. That'll give you 25% off. So go check it out. If you have any questions, let me know. Okay. Thanks to those that left ratings and reviews on iTunes this week. Remember, that keeps the show front and center. Also, remember, you can find me on Twitter at @beardonabike. That's @beardonabike. Also, I'm on Facebook, facebook.com/ShaneBlackshear123. And remember that Seminary Dropout is listener supported. You can visit supportseminarydropout.com and press Become a Patron. Remember, this music you're listening to right now is by D.L. Rossi. You can find him online on iTunes and at dlrossi.com. All right, thanks again for joining me for another episode of Seminary Dropout. Stay tuned for next week's episode. Love you. Take care. Yeah, that's my best.